I think we'll get our last speaker up for today, James Urban, author of the book Up by Roots. Thank you.
So, I'm a landscape architect. We've heard from one other landscape architect, two brave souls who will come up and talk in front of a bunch of soil scientists. I'm not a soil scientist. I've never had a single course in soils. And yet I wrote a 500-page book on soils, so I'm not sure how I did that. Let's see, I guess this little button here is our, so when I got into the soil business, what I realized very quickly that I needed to do was to bring the agricultural soil scientist together with the geotechnic soil scientist. You're two totally different professions, you speak in different languages, you even use different sizes for sand, silt, and clay. It's incredible when you think about that, but that's how different these two professions are. Yet when we get into the urban environment, both of those professions are fighting it out. One is trying to grow plants in the soil, and the other is actually trying to keep plants from growing in the soil. So you can see that there's a conflict. And guess who has more power? The geotechnic soil scientists are the powerful people in this relationship. So you need to figure them out very quickly. Most people, when they look at soils, especially landscape architects, and probably to some degree when you send soil out for soil tests, we talk about texture and nutrients and pH and organic matter and maybe soil organisms if we're really advanced. But we don't spend a lot of time on structure and density. And yet those two circles, soil structure and soil density, are the two things that really change the most in urban soils. So we've really got to focus in on those two bubbles. And this guy tamping on this gray stuff, to a geotechnic soil scientist, that's soil. 100% rock, yet it's soil to a geotechnic soil scientist. I'm going to skip over what urban soils are because we've got a lot of information on that already, so we don't have to waste any time on that. And I want to get right into the destruction of soils as part of our development process and also for soils that are intended to grow things. And one of the big things that I see us doing is that as we're harvesting soils, stockpiling soils for reuse, and specifying soils, we're grinding them up, we're screening them, we're trying to remove all the nasty things that are in soils, like a little bit of rock or a few roots or a root mat. And I've seen soil specifications for topsoils that require you remove all those things from the soil. And so therefore they have to be screened. Like a 0% tolerance for rock. We're talking about very, very fine screens that are required to reach these tolerances. And I think this is a really big problem. And the number one message here of my talk is we need lumpy, chunky soils. We need to preserve soil structure, even if it's massive soil structure. I think that there's some benefit in keeping some amounts of peds of massive soils in amongst the soil we've broken up as opposed to trying to break them all up into small little pieces. Most of the soil that's used in the urban area specified by landscape architects are soil mixes. We're no longer saying, you know, bring in topsoil from the country. I believe you guys mentioned about this landscape architect who wanted to throw away all the good black soil and bring in a soil mix. This is absolutely the common way things are done. And these soils are typically a mix of some amount of soil, some amount of sand, and some amount of compost in varying amounts. And the better soil specifications control the mix of the proportions of sand, silt, or sand, soil, and compost by looking at the infiltration rate of that mix when measured at a predetermined compaction rate, usually between 80 and 85% Proctor, so that you send the soil mix out, You get the proctor, the infiltration on it. If it's too low, you add more sand. If it's too high, you add more soil. Usually the compost stays about the same. This is the way I do this in my office. Actually, I get my mix. I get samples of the mix. We put them in mixing bowls at various things. We actually press it into a wire spaghetti strainer, making a little depression. I put water in it, and I watch the water come out the bottom. This gives me a ballpark range for the mix. I can very quickly make up different mixes in literally in my kitchen, until I get it so it's kind of dripping out the bottom at a rate which I think is about right. And I send it off to Norm Hummel, and he tests it for me. And it's amazing how close this really dumb, stupid methodology is for getting you in the ballpark. The contractors don't understand it. I used to write this in the spec, and now I just say, send me the components, and I'll tell you what the mix is. So it's this screening machine that we have to get rid of. We just have to get rid of it. I think it's an offshoot of the golf course soil mixing mentality. These machines are in every major market. They're very expensive. The soil blenders actually love it when you tell them that you don't have to use this machine because it reduces their cost by a considerable amount. And I think our soil, if I take a soil mix that is, say, 45% soil and 45% coarse sand and 10% compost, and I make it up with soil that has peds in it, or I grind all those peds up like this machine does, the infiltration rate doubles or triples or even quadruples when I use soil that has peds in it as opposed to taking that same soil and grinding it up. So the net result is we could use a lot less sand in our mixes if we stop grinding the soils up. Now, most soil scientists are pretty familiar with bulk density, grams per cubic centimeters or whatever. It's old school. The geotechnic engineers use something called proctor density. And there's very little information in the literature about bringing those two numbers together. And this is a chart in my book that I went and I took, found every source I could and every kind of soil I could, and started plotting them on this graph. And you can see the proctor curve, the circles are the 100% proctor, changing with soil type in exactly the same curve that the gray area is the area of root-limiting soils. And you can see where it changes from gray to white. That curve is almost exactly the same as the proctor curve. So the roots, whatever the engineer is looking for, the roots are looking for pretty much the same kind of dynamics as you move through the different soil types. But the question I have is, how do soil mixes fit into this curve? We have no data on that, and we really need you to do that. I forgot to mention in my paper, at the bottom of each section, there's a little italic place of research needed. And I'm hoping to inspire some of you who are researchers to read over some of those things and find some good research projects within that paper. So how do soil mixes fit in here? We don't know. We don't know what the right proctor is and what the root limiting is for soil mixes. And what is the role of structure in this data? We have no idea. I think it's pretty important, but we have no data on that. Now we take this soil that we purchased and we have to put it in the ground in some way that doesn't radically change it. It has to be compacted to some amount, but not too much. Generally, if you're putting it in thicker than about 18 to 20 inches, you need to start putting it down in layers so that you can't just dump it in the ground because it'll settle too much. And so all of those issues of how to do this correctly have to be in the specifications. And a lot of that information, of course, is in my book. Now, how do we measure that compaction? How do we tell if the contractor has over-compacted it or under-compacted it? The geotechnic engineers are going to use this thing called a densiometer or densitrometer, depending on which word processing system you have in your computer. It's expensive. That little machine is $10,000, and you've got to be a certified operator to make it operate. It can only measure density down to about 6 or 8 inches. It takes a couple of minutes, 3 or 4 minutes for each test. So you can't really test a large area. The only other tool I know is the penetrometer, which is very inexpensive, a couple of $100, but very inaccurate and very, its readings are changed by moisture and soil type quite dramatically. So I found it not to be a very good tool to do diagnostic work on. If I'm doing it on a dry day or a wet day, I'll get totally different answers. And it's also not very good to put in specifications. I can't say make the soil 1.5 megapascals or between 1 and 1.5 or whatever the right number is, because that number will change with soil moisture. So what we do is we get the soil tested using the nuclear densitometer in a mock-up. We then take the reading with a penetrometer, because we now know it's at the right density, and that little penetrometer I can use to make a test every 30 seconds completely across the site to depths up to 30 inches. So it's a very good tool when the two tools are combined. Now, we've had a lot of talk about what kind of soil it is, but you also need to know how much soil you actually need. And there's pretty good data. This is a chart that I made up in 1983 or 84 based on a whole bunch of other people's work. The ratio of tree volume size to soil volume. And this little sketch kind of shows you the size trees that you get on different amounts of soil. And you can see we're talking about a very, very large amount of soil to grow a really good tree. So because you're a soil scientist, maybe you are not good tree people, but essentially, as Tom Perry taught us, a tree is a wine glass on a dinner plate. And as you make the wine glass, the dinner plate, smaller and smaller, the tree simply gets smaller and smaller. So back in 1978, I started working on how to make these things work. We started out with soil trenches, of which the best one we could come up with has about 500 to 600 cubic feet of soil, or a half to a third of what we're looking for, but it seemed like a pretty good way to go. We built the first one in 1980, by year 12, we had some pretty spectacular-looking trees, and everybody was very impressed. The problem is, by year 16, we already started seeing holes in these trees. This is a 400 cubic foot tree. And the tree at year 16 had essentially grown to how big a tree the chart said could be supported by 400 cubic feet of soil, which actually is a lot of soil, but that's the best tree we got. By year 25, the tree was dead. We got about 20 good years out of that tree. By year 20, even the average person would say there was a problem with that tree. So in 1988, we started working on structural soil, and I worked a little bit with Nina on the first paper and wrote the original specifications for structural soil. But the problem with structural soil is that it's 80% rock and 20% soil. It is not a very effective way of putting soil in the ground. So what was but the trees actually did grow well at first until they ran out of soil. So if I dig up that whole sidewalk, I only add 200 cubic feet of soil. It's not a lot of soil. And in 2003, Nina published this paper, which basically says that the tree only reads the soil. That if we had the small loam and the large structural soil, which have the same, the small box and the large box have the same amount of soil in it, the tree grew to the same size, and only the tree that was growing in the larger box of soil grew much larger until it ran out of soil. So structural soil is not a very good way of putting large amounts of soil in the ground. So when Nina published that paper, I realized that that structural soil was not going anywhere for me, and so I needed a different methodology. So I started looking at a more efficient structural system, which essentially would have a very efficient structure that would hold up the pavement, and then you'd fill the space in between with soil. This resulted 3 years later in this product from a company called DeepRoot, which is called SilvaCells. Yeah, it takes about 7% of the volume for structure, and the rest of it is available for soil. And when I fill that whole sidewalk with SilvaCells, now I can get up to about 1,000 cubic feet of soil. I can start approaching the volumes that I'm looking for. One of the things that I love about SilvaCells is that they are incredibly forgiving on the kind of soil that you can put in it. You can put in a really good soil mix if that's where you're at. You could dig up the soil that is in the hole, that nasty stuff that comes out of from underneath the pavement, put some compost in it and stick it back in the SilvaCells. It's going to grow great trees. You could put in a bioretention mix. You can do just about any kind of soil that you can possibly imagine. Tom Smiley's been growing some trees in a mock-up of SilvaCells. We just finished year 7, and he's growing them with structural soil trees as a comparison and some other controls. But you can see the difference between the two systems after 7 years. So you can put in enormous sheets of this material if you've got money to do it. You might just put a few around the tree to make the space bigger, if that's all the money you have. The nice advantage of it is that it's a total. Each box is self-sufficient, so it doesn't require, it doesn't need the structure of the adjacent box. So you can put in 2 cells per tree. You can put in 100 cells per tree. It's just a function of how much money. I've been working on this problem since 1980. And everybody says this is the expensive system. It's really expensive, but actually, of all the systems I've designed, it's the cheapest way per cubic foot of soil to get soil in the ground. It's half the cost of structural soil. It's a little bit less than the soil trench idea. So it's actually, I've been trying to make the cheapest systems I can put in. But this is the only system I've done where I can actually get the volumes that I'm looking for. So if you're going to get into the urban soil business, you've got to learn about the construction business. How am I doing on time?
Captivated.
Oh.
You've got 12 minutes.
Oh, great. I only have 2 slides left. The construction business is totally different than the agricultural business in terms of specifications of how things get built. And we need to completely revamp the standards specifications. The new set of ARCOM master spec, which is going to come out this year, which I had a little bit to do with, is much better than the previous one, but still is a long way to go. There was discussion about the quality control on these issues and what those soil mixes should be. What are the regional implications of different soil sources as you move from Texas to Chicago to Boston? You're going to have different sets of specifications for different kinds of products that are available. And we also have to think about soil testing in a different way. Right now, almost all soils, when they're tested, go to a standard USDA lab using the protocol. And a lot of the tests I get on mine, first time they come through a geotechnic lab, which is using a totally different number for sand, silt, and clay, testing a totally different protocol. I always reject those, but it's amazing how often a landscape contractor will send a soil sample to a geotechnic soil lab for agricultural soil testing. I have a big problem that you all have to help me solve with the USDA testing protocol. And that is, first of all, the protocol, first thing they do is they sieve the soil sample through a 2-millimeter screen. All the gravel and large pieces of compost and a whole bunch of other things I just put in there, or maybe artifacts in there, are taken and put off on the side, and then the rest of the sample is tested. I need us to test soils the way they come off. I really don't want them screened. I'm not sure what screening does for you, and it probably has some scientific rationale, but I really would like you to challenge the screening of this soil. So we're testing the whole mix. Because in a soil mix, the organic matter is coming off of compost. Compost is only about 30% organic matter, and the rest of it's big clumps and chunks of things that may turn into something that is usable. It may have other functions in the soil in terms of buffering and improving drainage. And we need to understand the difference between compost and organic matter as it goes into the soil and as it comes out the other end as a soil test. I'm finding with my soil test, when I send out a soil mix, if I add 10% compost to a soil, when it comes out the other end, it's only increased, that's 10% by volume, it's only going to increase the soil organic matter by 1%, maybe 2%. And I'm not sure how much that's an artifact of just simply moving from dry weight or volume to dry weight and how much of it's a result of the screening, but I don't think it's telling me very much about what I've done with that compost. Second is that our soil mixes are made of washed sand. So I take the soil, and it's got sand, but those sand particles are all coated with clays and organic matter and other things that are affecting the plant and the way that sand particle will hold water. When I put washed sand in, it's going to perform quite differently. So I need some kind of a test that begins to tell me what the usefulness of the washed sand is versus the usefulness of a sand particle that may be an artifact in the topsoil. Finally, there's this use of the infiltration rate as a measuring stick for soil, and the fact that most of these tests are done when the soil has been all ground up and compacted in its little tube. So I need an infiltration rate test that begins to reflect the fact that I've got structure somewhere in that soil. It may just be a chunk of soil peb that's the size of a golf ball or the size of a grapefruit stuck in that soil, but how can I test the soil to give me some idea of whether the contractor has retained peds or has he not retained peds? So that is it. As I say, there are three copies to the three lucky people who want them of Up by Roots. If you want to drag it home, it's normally selling for about $90 on eBay, but it's $75 here. And I also take IOUs and promissory notes in payment. And other than that, I think we have some time for questions.
Yes, we have. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's a Proctor test, which is a percent of maximum density, but it's not actually truly the maximum density. What they do is they take a cone or a cylinder, they pack it with soil.
They take a disturbed sample.
Try to get it as compact as possible. Well, they compact it to the same number of blows, I think. So you take this piece, and I put whatever the number is, 25 blows of a 10-pound hammer, whatever the weight of the hammer is. I don't know the test by heart. And whatever that compaction is considered 100%. You probably, many soils could compact that more, but that's the 100% rate.
And so your graph showed 80% of that value.
Yeah, that root limiting.
Was tracking the root.
Yeah, the 80% value is tracking the edge, the outer edge or the lower edge of root limiting. Now, the interesting thing is that most landscape specifications require that planting soils be compacted to 85%. And right there, I'm going, there's some kind of problem here. So that's another specification change that needs to be made. Julia. Oh yeah, I completely forgot the optimum moisture too. Yeah, Julia, just to repeat Julia's comment, because probably didn't hear it in the back, she reminded me that I forgot to mention that the Proctor test also includes a optimum moisture content. So they'll do the Proctor test at a certain percentage moisture, and then they'll do it again, and they'll do it again, and they'll plot a curve to find the optimum moisture, and that's the 100% number. So it's factoring in that also. It's a pretty complicated little piece, and it's not the kind of thing you can sort of willy-nilly just go out and do in the field. And actually, bulk density testing in the field is pretty difficult. One of the things I'd like to throw out that I think is a possibility is I think your ground-penetrating radar, if the data is studied, may be able to yield us some density issues. There would be a lot easier data to get than mechanical extraction of a sample. Okay, yeah. Yeah, the question is, the compost is degrading over time, and what is that impact on the soil mix? All of these soil mixes that we're using, as far as I know, I haven't found it yet, have never been really scientifically tested. They're just sort of evolved, kind of like the FLL thing evolved. But it's never had the rigor of the FLL, which is a marvelous document. If you don't have that document, you should get it. It's a very, very great document. But we need you guys to start testing some of these soil mixes. How do they really support plants? Do some mixes take more water than others? Do they hold fertilizers better? We just don't know. We're spending $1 billion a year as an industry putting in these soil mixes, and there's no scientific research on it. The conversation that's going on up here for you in the back was that if you're growing plants in these sand soil mixes and the organic matter is degrading, evaporating off as it keeps composting, it's actually replaced by organic matter that the plants and the soil biology are infusing in the soil. And I asked the question earlier about exudates. And I think that exudates, when we finally get to study them, are going to really prove to be the game changer in these things. We know that prairie grasses exudate 80% of their total carbohydrate production goes into exudates. And we don't know much about trees, but I think they're going to be higher than 20%, which is sort of the low estimate, and maybe as much as 50%, maybe higher.
Right, and the other missing piece of that is mycorrhizae.
Yeah, but they're directly linked to the exudate issue. Yeah. Can we have one more question?
Okay.
We have one question in the back.
I thought the discussion about the Proctor test, that's a very arduous, very labor-intensive test. It can basically destroy everything. I always like a lot of tests are described as undisturbed soil. Basically, you've got a disturbed soil when you take it from the site and you take it to the lab. And if the question is, has anybody, to get away from these basically soil mechanical type tests, has anybody looked at doing like penetrometer tests, maybe with known soil moisture conditions on the site, especially for like root penetration?
Yeah, the question is about using penetrometers, which I I brought up as an issue. I've not been able to find good data on looking at many different soil types and their penetrometer readings at different densities and different moisture content. And that's another whole research project that somebody needs to undertake. I think the penetrometer in the end is going to be the right tool. We just don't have the data or graphs to calibrate it to the soils.
Okay. I would like to close up by thanking John Sloan, Ted Hartzig, Richard Pouillet, for actually putting this session together. I'd also like to thank most dearly our invited speakers. My eyes have been opened quite a lot, certainly bringing in the landscape architects. You know, I sample urban soils. I've sampled forest soils for years, and yes, I see a difference, and I'm very interested in the ecosystem services that they provide. Now I'm starting to see the issues that the geotech scientist guys are having and how we can work with them. So I've learned something. While we're advertising books, Urban Ecosystem Ecology, it came out in 2010. It's a publication of SSSA, ASA, CSA. It will be available at this meeting. Some of the speakers that were here today have chapters in here. I think it's a really good reference book. I think it's very useful. But thank you, everybody that came today. Thank you.